Good morning, and welcome to the virtual Sunday service of the West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, affectionately known as WUF. My name is Kim Transier. My pronouns are she and her, and it is my privilege to serve as your lay leader this morning. Whoever and wherever you are at this moment, you're welcome here. Whatever your age or abilities, skin color or birthplace, regardless of whom you love or how you identify your gender, whatever your spiritual practices may be, or if you have none, you're welcome here, and we're glad you're with us this morning. I hope you'll join our virtual coffee hour at 11:30. Follow the link in your order of service email. At coffee hour, we check in with each other, share our joys and sorrows, and talk about today's service. I also encourage you to look at the announcements attached to your order of service to see what else is happening at WUF this week. If this is your first time with us and you don't have an order of service, but you'd like to know more about who we are and how we stay connected this summer, please get in touch with our congregational administrator. Her contact information will appear on your screen after the service. When I light our chalice, the symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, I will ask you to consider these words by Leslie Takahashi. All that we have ever loved and all that we have ever been stands with us on the brink of all that we aspire to create. A deeper peace, a larger love, a more embracing hope, a greater joy in this life we share. Please speak with me now our opening affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another. In today's service, we'll reflect on the story of the American West and how it has shaped us. And we're honored to welcome Molly Gloss as our speaker. Molly is a novelist and short story writer whose work has received, among other honors, a Penn West Fiction Prize, an Oregon Book Award, a Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award, a Whiting Writers Award, and the C.E.S. Wood Distinguished Writer Award. She writes both realistic fiction and science fiction, and her work in both genres most often concerns the landscape, life, and mythology of the American West. A fourth-generation Oregonian, she lives in Portland. She has selected today's reading. Welcome, Molly. Thank you for coming.
A reading from the novel Ceremony by Laguna Pueblo writer Leslie Marmon Silco. I will tell you something about stories, he said. They aren't just entertainment. Don't be fooled. They are all we have, you see. All we have to fight off illness and death. You don't have anything if you don't have stories. Their evil is mighty, but it can't stand up to our stories. So they try to destroy the stories, let the stories be confused or forgotten. They would like that. They would be happy because we would be defenseless then. He rubbed his belly. I keep them here, he said. Here, put your hand on it. See? It is moving. There is life here for the people. And in the belly of this story, the rituals and the ceremony are still growing.
Spirit was
Let us enter together a moment of silence for prayer, meditation, or reflection. I invite you to bring to mind or speak aloud the names of anyone you may wish to join us in a circle of peace and compassion.
I must have been about 16 when I read Shane for the first time. A few years ago, I would have been sure that everybody in my audience would know what I was talking about. Maybe not Jake Schaefer's novel, but for sure the movie, Shane. But I've learned that I can't count on that now, so here's a little summary. Shane is set in the classic landscape of paperback westerns during the post-Civil War rush of homesteaders into the West, 1889, Wyoming Territory. It's narrated by a homesteader's young son, Bob Sterrett. The Sterrett homestead and the homesteads of their neighbors have staked claims on the open range that until lately has been used by a cattleman named Luke Fletcher. Shane is a mysterious stranger who rides into and then out of the lives of the Sterrett family. He's quiet, always silent about his past. He does not wear a gun, and yet everyone seems to understand that he's a dangerous man. The boy's father, Joe Sterrett, hires Shane as a hand on his farm, and Shane puts aside his silk neckerchief, his black gunslinger's clothes, and buys dungarees. The homesteaders are a small community of farmers. Fletcher is a powerful, wealthy man with a large herd of cattle. He's trying to regain access to the open range by pushing out the homesteaders. So Shane, of course, helps Sterrett and his neighbors hold fast against Fletcher and his hired men. But in the end, Shane straps on his guns again, goes into the saloon, one against many, and afterward rides away wounded and alone into the dark night as the boy calls after him, "Come back, Shane. Shane, come back." There's a Charles Schulz cartoon I'm very fond of. Charlie Brown sitting in front of a television set watching this scene and sadly lamenting, "Shane, he never did come back." It's our classic American myth. A man with a dark past comes out of the Wild West where his strength of character was forged and where he's learned how to fight and shoot. He would give up his guns if he could, but we need him to save us from the bad guys. And so he does the necessary killing, and then he heads back into the wilderness alone. Like countless other gunslinger heroes, his success is freighted with sorrow because he is wearied of violence, but he cannot escape it. And ironically, in Shane, as in so many Western novels, the fight that he wages is on behalf of the farmers, the homesteaders, who are putting up fences and closing off the open range that has been the domain of free-spirited wanderers and footloose paladins like him. In the elegiac world of the Western novel, our wilderness paradise is always just about to end, despite and because of the sacrifice of our gunslinger hero, the taming of the West that will make him an anachronism. The story is seen through the eyes of a young boy, a boy puzzled and entranced by Shane's hidden violence, a boy who comes to trust, love, and venerate him. Jack Schaefer said about his novel, "It's an American boy's dream of the world as it should be." I've gone back to reread Shane many times over the years, and I've each time seen it through a different lens. By the time I was 20, I had read all the classic literature of the West, from the Virginian to Honey and the Horn. And then the women, Willa Cather, Mari Sandos, Dorothy Johnson, women who told a different story about the West, a story not so much about heroes as about ordinary people and the way their lives were tied to the land. I read the homesteaders' memoirs, the trail drive reminiscences, the diaries and letters of the early comers, and I learned, among other things, that the real history of the West was not a history of lone riders and solitary gun-toting heroes. but a communal enterprise. And finally, I read the memoirs of writers who were third or fourth generation on their family's ranches, who had begun to ask what it was we thought we were conquering when we won the West. Myths are not lies. They're the stories we tell ourselves about the past so we can try to understand who we are as a people, what we care about, how we conduct ourselves. They're larger than life. They're legends about heroes and heroic battles. They're mostly about men. We're a young country. We haven't got Beowulf, Odysseus, Galahad to hark back to. We've got this natural, understandable hunger for a heroic past, so we look to the only period of our Anglo history that comes anywhere close to a heroic age, those 25 or 30 years when we were pushing our way into the West and, ironically, pushing out the very people whose own legends and heroic myths might have given us the stories we yearned for. The American West is inarguably a landscape more beautiful and vast and rugged than anything on the East Coast or in the South or in the Old Country. In America's mythic story of the West, the trappers, the cowboys, the settlers out on the plains or in the mountains, far removed from doctors, from stores, from policemen, had no choice but to solve their own problems, shoe their own horses, repair their own wagon wheels, hang their own criminals. Westerners in this story wore leather and packed guns, and it was this mythic struggle against the Western wilderness that shaped the American character, so the myth tells us, made us as a people, free-thinking, fearless, tough, self-reliant, independent. The myth of the West and the Western hero of countless novels and films defines who we are as Americans, both in our own minds and in the perception of much of the rest of the world. The mountain man, the cowboy, the gunslinger have filled the same role for us as King Arthur and his knights in English mythology. And they are the center of our storytelling even now, with the Western seemingly in decline. The gunslinger, the mountain man, the cowboy have simply moved downtown and into outer space. They've put on the clothes of the hard-boiled detective, the go-it-alone, rule-breaking cop, the vigilante hero, the superhero. From John Wayne to John Wick, from the cowboys in Louis L'Amour to the private eyes in Lee Child's novels, from Bruce Willis in Die Hard to Keanu Reeves in Speed, from the Terminator to Han Solo, such men have long been our cultural heroes, and they are still shooting it out with the bad guys in the mean streets of New York and Boston and L.A. and Tatooine. They've gone to virtual worlds and outer space where the same old story is being reenacted by Arnold Schwarzenegger as an android Shane protecting the boy and his mother from the younger, stronger gunman from out of town. And that cowboy hero in all his modern iterations, as he came to be embodied in novels and films, is the central image of our American myth. Shane and all his successors is a rootless loner, lacking family ties and a childhood history. He's one in a long line of American fictional heroes who prize their independence and their wandering above the obligations of community, who have chosen loneliness and isolation over the embrace of family. Quoting from the novel now, Shane was a man who seemed to come from nowhere and appeared equally determined to pass on to nowhere. The cowboy myth is in some respects one of an endless childhood. The hero has no parents and is not himself a parent, nor does he wish to be. He does not marry because marriage would mean the end of his picaresque adventures. In the myth of the West, our hero rides his horse across unfenced golden fields, spreads his bedroll beside unpolluted mountain streams, wakes in the pink light of dawn to see deer browsing on the meadow with his pure white stallion. In this story, he is both intimate with the wild earth and he is the one who has tamed it. You have seen this story unfolding in every advertisement for an off-road SUV. The West in this story comprises Montana and the High Rockies, Monument Valley, Utah, the nameless hidden canyons of a Zane Grey novel. The West of this story is never a nuclear waste dump in eastern Washington. It's not the Las Vegas Strip or the smoggy sprawl of modern Phoenix. It's not deadbeat dads or road rage or a boy shooting up his high school. It's not the raging poverty and alcoholism of the res, and it's not the gangs of L.A. dishing out vigilante justice in the streets. Yet the cowboy hero brought all those things west with him as surely as he brought his horse and his gun. Received narratives too often tell us who to love or to hate, whether to see or be blind. Often, too often, stories saddle us, ride us, whip us onward. They tell us what to do, and we do it without questioning. We haven't wanted to think too hard about the paradoxes and ambivalences of Western American settlement, or look too closely at the baleful shadows in the Western myth, the dark side of the cowboy hero. How are we to understand our lives and this place where we live if we can no longer believe in the old narratives that have figured so large in American life, the uncomplicated stories in which our perseverance and our endurance of hardships led to a noble settlement of the West? People came into the West thinking they'd been promised something, at least freedom and the possibility of starting a new life. When things didn't work out or neighbors got too close, they moved farther west to try again or to seek a new challenge or new land to break. But of course, our expectation of golden riches, golden dreams out west, often led to disappointment. Land was open for homesteading even where the ground was unsuitable for plowing, even where there was insufficient rainfall and no possibility of irrigation. The dry land west is littered with the dilapidated shacks of abandoned homesteads. When the timber was cut or burned, when the soil had been exhausted, when the game was killed off, when the claim petered out, or the crops dried up, or the cows had eaten the grass down to its roots, people packed up and headed farther west, following a trail they hoped would lead them to new and better opportunities. But it was not the miners who struck pay dirt, it was the mining corporations. Not the loggers, but the lumber barons. And often the cowboy was not an armed nobleman on horseback, but an overworked, underpaid wage slave for an absentee English cattle baron or an Eastern investment corporation, just as now the Western wanderers of the film Nomadland are seasonal workers in a vast Amazon warehouse. And as people used up the land and moved on, they left a backwash of the defeated and the discouraged. When the Western story did not come true, the result was alienation. "The poor you will always have with you," Jesus may have said. But in the American West, poverty was viewed as a failure of the dream. And we are reaping that whirlwind now. My own writing has been shaped by a lifetime of affection for and frustration with Western literature and the American heroic myth. I've had to come to terms with the knowledge that our Western story is a story of breaking the wild land, its animals, its native peoples, by brutal, violent conquest. The Western belief that a man should be free to do what he wants to do with his own land, insistence on freedom regardless of the cost to community, I now know has been the rationale for more than a century of overgrazing, overcutting, suburban sprawl, hydraulic dredging, pit mining, has been the rationale for Las Vegas, Nevada, sitting on the driest landscape of the West, to drain down the Colorado River and the underground western aquifers in order to put on its watery casino displays and keep green its acres of improbable manicured lawns. And of course, our mythic history takes no notice of Indian genocide, vigilanteism, brutalities against the Mexicans, the Chinese. Above all, I've recognized that the Western story solves every problem with violence. Our hero lives by the code of the West. If he's insulted or cheated, if his favorite hat is tromped on, if someone kisses his girl on the cheek, he must fight or he's a coward. If his horse, or now it would be his car, a Mustang Shirley or a Silverado, is stolen, our hero, above the law, will always dispense his own violent justice and punishment. Toxic masculinity is a feature of patriarchy around the world. But in America, it is Shane I have seen hanging out with the Proud Boys, the sovereign citizen movement, the pro-gun movement. I certainly have seen him walking the halls in Washington, D.C. We're in love with Shane, but he's the guy our mothers warned us against. I'm not the only one looking harder now at the old myth of the Western, the stories about gunslingers and cowboys and savages. Craig Leslie and Betty Lynch Husted and Kent Harif are among the writers I know exploring an emotional truth of life in the West. Jane Kirkpatrick's stories keep the values of the old myth, the courage, the self-reliance, the toughness, but tell stories in which those values are informed and mindful. Recent novels of S.M. Hulse and Rebecca Claren have looked hard at the human place on the Western landscape, the damage we've done and are doing, and the women and men looking for a way toward redemption. Ursula Le Guin and Kim Stanley Robinson have imagined new myths that show us how we might live generation after generation respectfully on this land. These are among the writers whose storytelling helps us understand who we are in the world and helps us think in fresh ways about ourselves as we might become, instead of reinforcing our old notions of the brave, tough cowboy we think we ought to be. They are all telling stories about the Western lives of women as well as men, stories of indigenous people, people of every ethnic and cultural and religious tribe, heroic stories not of lone gunmen, but of the small towns that can be found everywhere in the West, where the relations of the people to the land are the most direct and intense, and where some of the people have roots that go back generations. Stories of kinship between people and the courage of ordinary lives, even in terrible circumstances, even in the face of intolerance and ignorance. Stories in which personal freedom is a noble dream, but only if it includes a sense of responsibility and independence that gives us strength, but not when it means cutting our ties to family and community. We are all, as I think of it, writing stories, our stories, to persuade Shane that the cowboy life doesn't have to be so damn lonesome and bloody. I imagine him one day pulling a book out of his saddlebag, one of mine maybe, and beginning to read. I imagine him beginning to care about the people in those pages and beginning to feel part of those communities, beginning to question the story he's always been told about what it means to be a hero, about who he is and how to conduct himself and what kind of person he might become. I even try to imagine that he might one day become a storyteller himself, might turn his own story into a great legend of place, of peacemaking, of adaptation to the land and its animals, instead of a story about a wandering warrior who solves problems with his gun and then disappears into the heart of darkness. And in this story, I'm imagining, one day he hangs up his guns for good.
desperado. Why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one. I know that you've got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you, they hurt you somehow. Don't you draw the Queen of Diamonds, boy? She'll beat you if she's able. You know the Queen of Hearts is always your best bet. It seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the ones that you can get. Desperado, oh, you ain't getting younger. Your pain and your driving you home, and freedom, oh yeah, freedom, that's just some people talking. Your prison is walking through this world all alone. Don't you think it cold in the winter time when the sky won't snow and the sun shine? It's hard to tell the night time from the day. And you're losing all your highs and lows. Ain't it funny how the feeling goes away? Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? Come down from your fences. Open the gate. It may be raining, but there's a rainbow above you. You better let somebody love. Thank you.
Now, as we close our time together, we extinguish our chalice, but not the warmth and inspiration of our faith. May we carry its flame within us until we meet again.